to be broken, and I'm not brave enough to recommend one over another.
It's a good thing I don't wear a corset, Anna said under her breath a little later. I'd be ready to pop just about now. I may do that anyway.
Jack rubbed her back. Savard, you have to learn to say no.
She laughed at him outright. That's the way to endear myself to your mother and aunts. I'll eventually say no when necessary, but not today. A short walk would help.
Everybody close enough to hear this stopped eating and looked at her. Concern writ clear on their faces. Anna wondered if the idea of a walk violated some unwritten law, but Jack climbed over the bench to stand and held out a hand.
I think a walk is a good idea.
The look he gave her said very clearly that he knew she was up to something, but that he had no intention of disappointing her or even asking questions that might be taken as less than supportive.
Ma chiaramente,
Anna heard Jack's father say softly.
Sono sposini novelli.
When they were out of hearing, Anna looked at him expectantly.
Newlyweds, Jack explained. Sposini novelli, that's us. We can get away with a lot on that basis.
She found herself smiling. You don't get away with much otherwise.
You did just spend time with my mother, Jack said. What do you think?
At the corner of Fifth Avenue and Washington Square Park, they worked their way through a crowd of children watching a puppet show, past an organ grinder whose monkey held out a greasy old hat for coins, newsboys hawking their papers, and push carts displaying cans of tobacco, cigars, hard candy, handkerchiefs, small Italian and American flags, peanuts, inexpensive jewelry, and religious medals. When they were free of the worst of the crowds, Jack took her hand, and they walked north.
Oscar is always uneasy on this part of Fifth Avenue, Jack said. He got caught up in the draft riots around here, just a couple of days after he joined the force. Do you remember anything about them?
I remember the noise, but that's all. We were a household of women and children, and we locked ourselves in, you see. Uncle Quinlan was dead. Mr. Lee was in the army somewhere in the South, and Margaret had come to stay with her boys. We weren't allowed out of the house during the riots, not even in the garden. Auntie wouldn't even let us see the newspapers once it was all over.
Jack looked almost relieved to hear this.
So, Savard, he said, where exactly are we going?
Patience, just a couple more minutes.
She would have raised the subject of the suspicious ad in the paper, but Anna had begun to doubt her suspicions and could no longer see a connection between the newspaper clippings and the deaths of three women. She would only embarrass herself, like a child who came into the hospital with a scratch and demanded a plaster cast. Then again, Jack wouldn't laugh at her, even if there was nothing of merit in what she wanted to show him. He would listen and they would talk about it. Then, she was almost certain, he would put her suspicions to rest and they would go back to listen to the band and watch the children playing as the day slipped away to evening. As they turned west on 9th Street, Jack said,
We talked to Archer Campbell this morning, Oscar and me.
Anna was glad of the distraction.
About the money question?
Mostly. She had over $1,000 with her when she left with the boys that morning, but there was no trace of it on her person or in the house when it was searched after her death. Campbell thinks she paid somebody to take the boys in.
Anna considered. So you were correct. She had enough money to pay a reputable doctor. But how would she find someone to take four young boys she could trust? $1,000 is a great deal of money. But at the very minimum, that would have to last 15 years.
Jack said, We don't know where the money went. The house was empty for a good while once the ambulance took her away. And then there's the ambulance ride itself. I've arrested more than one orderly with pockets full of cash and jewelry they took off their charges. Chances are slim we'll be able to pin anything down, but it's worth looking at.
Jefferson Market came into view, all the stalls empty and shuttered on a Sunday afternoon. In a few hours, the aisles would be full of street Arabs and the outdoor poor, who would fight to keep a spot under that leaky tin roof. A few were already standing nearby in the shadow of the 6th Avenue elevated train tracks. At the sight of Jack, they slipped away around corners. Behind the market, the red brick bulk of the Jefferson Courthouse loomed. Proud and fanciful both, in an island of small houses and tenements, home mostly to skilled workers and small business owners.
"Now I'm even more curious," Jack said, teasing. "You can't mean to take me on a tour of the courthouse. The police station?"
Anna said, "No. Look there." She nodded toward the storefronts that faced the market. A tailor, a cobbler, a greengrocer, a steam laundry. Between the grocer and the cobbler, one shop stood out, a little wider than the others, the awning newer, the show windows spotless. The weathered sign was the only thing that gave away the shop's age. Old-fashioned script spelling out the name G.E.O. Smithson, apothecary. There were dozens of druggist shops like it in the city, but Smithson was one of the oldest and most respected. The shop was closed on a Sunday, of course, but she had counted on that. Jack was watching her, curious but patient. She took the newspaper cuttings from her reticule and handed him the one on the top. "I came across that first advertisement by accident early today. I was a little later than I should have been to the picnic, because I stopped to buy different newspapers to look through." She fanned out the other clippings for him to see. Of the 5 I bought, 4 had identical ads. Jack studied the clippings briefly, then glanced across the street to the druggist. "What you probably don't know," she went on, "is that neighborhood midwives almost always have a druggist they work with, where they consult and get whatever preparations they need. Druggists keep a list of midwives who work in the area and take messages for them. Some druggists work with only one or two midwives they trust. My cousin, Amelie, I haven't told you about her yet, worked with Smithson for more than 30 years before she gave up her practice. Another midwife took her place. Her name was Sarah Conroy, but she's retired now, too. I'm not sure who's working with Smithson now, but this," she touched the newspaper advertisement, "this makes me wonder." Jack was listening closely, keeping his thoughts to himself. Anna knew her voice had gone hoarse, but she would tell all of it. She had to tell all of it. "Amelie was an excellent midwife. People still talk about her. Sarah was just as good, and both of them would help women who came to them in trouble." She saw that he understood. For a long moment, he considered the newspaper clipping, and then he took in a deep breath and let it go. Jack asked,
"Do you know who took Sarah's place? Who's working with Smithson now?"
"No, not with any certainty. But I could find out."
"Wait," Jack said. "Let me see if I follow your thinking. A woman comes to talk to this Smithson when she's looking for a midwife, either to deliver her when the time comes, or to regulate her courses."
He was using the euphemistic wording from the newspaper. "To end the pregnancy," Anna clarified. "Yes."
"And it's always worked that way?"
"It's not the only way a woman finds a midwife, but it is one way, yes."
"And you're thinking that this Dr. DePaul is trying to get the attention of women who come to Smithson's for this purpose?"
"When you say it like that, it sounds very far-fetched."
"No," Jack said. "I see it that way, too. But there are a couple of other possible explanations. First, it could be nothing more than a way to stand out from the other advertisements. This DePaul might be running the more usual kind of ad as well. He's just casting a wider net.
Anna managed a shaky smile. Of course, I should have thought of that.
Hold on, I wasn't finished.
He cradled the back of her neck in one hand and drew her into him, put his mouth to her ear. Sometimes a thing feels just a little bit off, not quite right. That's probably what you picked up, that feeling, because I've got a whiff of it too. So let's talk to Oscar about this. Put our heads together.
A train rattled by overhead, and they stayed just as they were until it was gone. Then Anna pulled back to look at him directly. You're not just humoring me.
Hell no, Jack said. He gave her a grim smile. I've got my faults, but I'm not stupid. You'd never stand for that, and I wouldn't want you to.
They were cutting across the park and almost back to the family when Jack saw that Anna's Aunt Quinlan was walking toward home, braced on either side by Elise and Margaret. Just that quickly, Anna's expression shifted to what Jack had come to think of as her professional mask. Without discussion, they both broke into a jog. By the time they caught up, Anna had managed to produce an easier smile. She said, You are more sensible than I am, Auntie. I should take a nap, too.
Her aunt wasn't so easily taken in. Don't fuss, I'm perfectly fine. Jack, take that girl back to the picnic, would you? She's going to try my patience.
The uncharacteristic peevish tone seemed not to alarm Anna, but to put her worries to rest. You'll send word if you need me.
Of course I will. Give me a kiss and go on. You too, Elise. And don't argue with me, I won't have it. A short walk will do me good. I'll send Margaret back just as soon as I'm settled.
Jack said,
Don't I have any say in this?
Four faces turned to him. He sighed in mock disappointment, leaned down, and moving gently, lifted Anna's beloved aunt into the cradle of his arms.
Don't fuss, he said to her. I won't have it.
And he started down the street at a brisk pace. For a moment, he thought she was going to box his ears, but suddenly she gave a squawk of a laugh and relaxed.
You do remind me sometimes of my Simon. I had a difficult time when I was expecting Blue, and so he carried me everywhere.
She looped an arm around his neck and patted his cheek.
I'm so glad to know you'll be looking after my Anna.
It wasn't more than a quarter hour before he got back to the park, but Rosa and Leah were lying in wait and jumped out at him. He took one look at their expressions and crouched down.
Aunt Quinlan is just fine, he said. Nothing to worry about.
We're not worried, Rosa said. We're confused.
About?
Leah leaned against his arm and pointed.
See that man over there?
Jack recognized Ned from the way he held himself, a young man neatly if plainly dressed, his posture erect but his shoulders bent forward toward Anna while she talked, the very picture of manly solicitude.
I do. His name is Baldy, or Ned. What about him?
All the brimming energy left them just that simply, because this information only confused them further. They wanted to know why he would have two names and which was the right one. When it turned out that Jack had no satisfactory explanation for this strange state of affairs, they went ahead with their story, which had to do with Anna Bambina and Baldy Ned. Jack winced, but didn't interrupt to correct them because they were off at a gallop. It seemed that Baldy Ned had walked right up to Anna, had smiled at her and called her Dr. Anna, and asked
Was it true she had gone ahead and married the Dago detective sergeant, contrary to common good sense, which had gotten Anna to laugh the way ladies laughed when they were being teased and liked it? The confusing part was Bambina, who, it seemed to them, had taken an instant dislike to Baldy Ned. She didn't like what he said or the way he said it, or the idea that Baldy Ned was going to teach Anna Italian, something that had come out, and wasn't that good news that Anna was learning Italian? And then Baldy Ned had just smiled at Bambina and called her Cara.
She didn't like that at all, that he called her Cara, Rosa said. But it's a nice thing to call somebody.
Leah, hopping in place, wanted to know what it meant that Bambina turned all red and her jaw got tight. Most important, what did it mean when Anna said that he, Jack, had introduced her, Anna, to Baldy Ned with perfect manners, and that Bambina might want to follow her brother's example? It was all very confusing and sad, because they thought Baldy Ned was nice, and they would like him, too, to come around to the house to talk Italian, to Anna and to them, too.
So, Rosa said, can you fix it?
Before he could even get to Anna, the band started up, and Baldy Ned disappeared. There would be no fixing of anything, or even any talking over the music, which would give Jack some time to think. He was glad of it. Rosa and Leah plopped themselves down on the blanket where Anna had settled, and Jack followed their example. He leaned against Anna and bumped her shoulder with his own. She smiled at him, and both dimples came to the fore, a welcome sight that put his worries to rest. Whatever trouble Bambina had stirred up, it hadn't robbed Anna of her mood. He wondered if he should talk to his mother about her youngest and most troublesome daughter, and decided that it would only make things worse. Instead, he leaned into Anna and threaded his fingers through hers. Despite the brass and drums, he was half asleep himself, and would have dropped off when the band took a break, if Oscar hadn't come to crouch beside them. I am going to talk to that Graham, the young ambulance doctor who testified in the Campbell case. I'll fill you in tomorrow. Anna leaned across Jack to smile at Oscar.
Working on a Sunday evening in June?
Anna, my dear, he said with a puff of breath that might have been 60 proof. I love my work. Why don't you two come along, Jack? Oscar said. She speaks doctor after all, and she might find it interesting.
I would, Anna agreed, nudging this time with her elbow. Take me along, mezzanotte. I'm interested.
Anna wondered at herself, that she would find this so compelling. She would be quiet and observant, she promised herself, and hoped it was a promise she could keep. Neil Graham had a room in a boarding house not 5 minutes from Bellevue, a rambling, threadbare place typical of the living quarters interns and medical students could afford. The carpet was worn, but there wasn't a stain or stray dust mote to be seen anywhere. The landlady introduced herself as the widow Jennings and blinked at them while Oscar talked. Then she cleared her throat and straightened her shoulders.
I've been letting rooms to young men studying to be doctors for 20 years now, she said, leading them into the parlor. Since the day Mr. Jennings did us all a favor and dropped down dead. Terrible mean he was. Awful mean. There I was with this big house and no money. He was a drinker, you see, was Mr. Jennings. Drank himself into an early grave. Just not quite early enough. So I said to myself, Hitty, young people would bring some joy into this vale of tears, and I've had every room occupied ever since I started. Because I'm fair, you see. I don't overcharge, and I cook good plain food, but plenty of it. My boarders don't go hungry, and I don't stick my nose where it don't belong, I can promise you that. Now you have to tell me why you're wanting to talk to young Neil Graham. I can't say my boys never get in trouble, but I'm surprised to hear it's Neil you're fixed on. Can't hardly remember a nicer boy, hard-working, polite. His grandfather lives way downtown, which is why he boards with me. A responsible young man. I always wanted a son, but instead I just had Mr. Jennings, and he gave me nothing but heartache and moneylenders at the door and crabs more than once.
Anna bit back a laugh, because really it wasn't at all funny. Unexpected, but not funny. It was only a very small comfort to see that Oscar had gone red in the face, too. Jack was better at hiding things. He was saying, "Could we speak to him here in your parlor, Mrs. Jennings?"
"Yes, of course. Just sit, make yourselves comfortable. I'll fetch him."
When the sound of her climbing the stairs faded away, Oscar drew in a hiccupy laugh, shook his head, and took out a handkerchief to wipe his eyes. His shoulders were still shaking when Neil Graham came through the parlor door, one side of his face pillow-creased and his hair standing up.
"Keeping odd hours, Dr. Graham."
Oscar's tone was vaguely accusatory. Anna's impulse was to explain that interns learned to sleep whenever the opportunity presented itself, but she stopped. Oscar might be provoking the young man on purpose. Neil Graham gave a soft laugh.
"You could say that."
With thumb and forefinger, he rubbed his eyes for a moment and then opened them to focus on Anna.
"Dr. Savard, is this about the Campbell case?"
"It is," Jack said. "We want to hear about that day again, in as much detail as you can summon."
Mrs. Jennings appeared in the doorway with a tray laden down with a teapot and cups. "But first a cup of tea," Anna said. "That will wake you up. Thank you, Mrs. Jennings. You are very thoughtful." The cup of tea did its work. Graham talked for 10 minutes, telling them when he got up that morning and when he reported for his shift on the Bellevue Ambulance Service.
"And your first call, when did that come?"
"I'd have to check my notes to be sure, but it was about 7:15. An omnibus clipped a boy on the Bowery near Clinton. We got there about 8:30, and I worked on the boy about 10 minutes before we got him loaded into the ambulance."
In Anna's experience, interns were often not at their best in a critical situation like the one he was describing, but in his memory, at least, he had followed a sensible course of action. He talked about the boy's death in the ambulance in the same measured tone, with some regret, but without guilt, which said to Anna that he was competent and realistic, in control of his emotions when he was working. He talked about 2 more calls, about eating the lunch that Mrs. Jennings packed, the cost included in his room and board.
"And what time did you get the call about Mrs. Campbell?"
"I can tell you we got word from the Jefferson Market precinct desk sergeant at 1:00. It was a baker's boy who brought word to the station, but I only know that because I heard the neighbor lady say so on the stand."
He took a swallow of cold tea, put down the cup very carefully, and placed his hands flat on his knees.
"The Campbell house is maybe 3 blocks from Jefferson Market, so we got there quick. The door was standing open and there were neighbors milling around, the way they do when there's trouble. You must see that happen all the time."
He looked at Oscar, who gave him a curt nod. Oscar was not exactly severe or disapproving, but he didn't give Graham much indication of how he was doing. Jack rarely looked up from his note-taking. Anna was curious about what it all meant, if the two men were exchanging information in some way she didn't recognize. Graham was saying,
"I went in with my bag, through the parlor and a hall into the kitchen. The neighbor, I'm forgetting her name."
"Mrs. Stone,"
Oscar said. "Mrs. Stone was standing in the bedroom doorway, wringing her hands. There was a pool of blood on the kitchen floor and a trail into the bedroom. I didn't ask her direct, but I assumed that Mrs. Stone had helped Mrs. Campbell get from the kitchen into bed. I asked her to stay in the kitchen, and I went in and examined Mrs. Campbell. Do I need to go over her condition again?"
When Oscar said yes, he did need to go over every detail, Graham looked uncomfortable for the first time.
His manner changed, and his gaze shifted to Anna, as if he preferred to talk to a male physician about such things. It had to do with his training, something Anna could mention later. When he paused, Oscar said,
"Tell me what you said and what she said, to the best of your memory."
I said who I was, and I asked her to lie flat on her back so I could examine her. She just turned her head, wouldn't say anything. I asked a lot of questions about the pain and when it had started. I asked if she had had an operation, but she didn't say one word. The only sound she made was crying out when I palpated her abdomen. So I opened the door and called to the driver he should bring the stretcher, and he did, and we got her off the bed and onto it. She didn't say a word to me.
Oscar's head turned toward him, quite sharply.
Did she say a word to somebody else?
Graham looked flustered.
Mrs. Stone was talking to her, the way people do in that kind of situation. She said, oh no, Janine, and my poor girl, and it was too much, and other things like that. And she touched her, her face, and stroked her hair. I think Mrs. Campbell might have said a few words back then, but I couldn't say for sure. We were trying to maneuver the stretcher through the little hall, and the floor was slippery with blood. The last I remember of Mrs. Stone was her standing in the door, her hands clutched to herself.
He demonstrated.
She was weeping, quiet, but weeping a waterfall. Then, in the ambulance, Mrs. Campbell spoke to me direct for the first time. She said she wanted to be taken to the New Amsterdam. She grabbed onto my sleeve hard and said it twice, Dr. Savard at the New Amsterdam. And that's what we did. She didn't talk to you otherwise. I was surprised she managed that much in her condition. She didn't say anything more.
And where was Mrs. Campbell's purse in all of this?
Graham blinked, confused.
Her purse?
Was her purse on the stretcher with her?
I don't...
Mrs. Campbell had more than $1,000 in her purse that has never been recovered. What became of that money, do you think?
Neil Graham's mouth fell open. People often described such things, but Anna couldn't remember ever seeing someone's jaw drop. The color left his face, and his gaze jerked from Oscar to Jack and then to Anna. She did her best to keep her expression neutral.
Are you asking, he said, and stopped. Are you saying? I think it was clear. Mrs. Campbell had $1,000 with her that day, and that money disappeared.
Now Graham's color came back in a rush.
I took nothing. There wasn't anything to take. She didn't have any purse or satchel with her. I didn't see a single coin, and I certainly didn't take anything. Are you charging me with a crime?
Jack stood up.
If you allow us to search your room, that will go some way to clearing you.
He shook his head when Graham got to his feet.
I'll ask Mrs. Jennings to show me to your room, and she can stand by and watch. But you need to stay here. I'll come along with you, Oscar said.
He looked at Anna, as somber as she had ever experienced him.
Will you sit here with Dr. Graham?
Yes, Anna said. Gladly. When they were the only two left in the parlor, Neil Graham buried his face in his hands and rocked forward, a man in shock. When he looked at her again, his eyes were red-rimmed.
This will be the end of my career, he said hoarsely. It doesn't matter that I'm innocent. If word gets out, I'm finished.
Anna thought of many things she could say. First and foremost was the simple truth. He was correct. But it was also true that Jack and Oscar didn't really suspect Neil Graham of anything. Anna understood that they were staging a drama in the hope that unsettling the young man would jog his memory, and he would remember exactly what Mrs. Campbell said to Mrs. Stone. Finally, she poured more tea into his cup, a gesture that he might take for sympathy or understanding. He said,
Dr. Savard,
Jack and Oscar were back, followed by Mrs. Jennings, whose hands were fluttering like birds.
"Clean as a whistle," Jack said.
He looked at Anna and tilted his head to the door. She looked at Graham, who had once again lost control over his jaw. He got to his feet, his knee knocking the side table so that the cups and saucers clattered.
"You're not charging me with anything?"
Oscar took his hat off the coat rack and turned to smile, as if the entire conversation had never happened.
"Nothing to charge you with, Dr. Graham. You did your best with poor Mrs. Campbell. Thank you for your time. Wait, one more thing."
He gave a thoughtful pause. "When you last saw Mrs. Stone standing in front of the house with her hands folded on her breast, what was she holding?"
Graham blinked and blinked again.
"A purse," he said. "A black purse." "And where did the purse come from?"
A silent shake of the head.
"I swear I don't know." "Fair enough. Thank you, Dr. Graham."
Anna said, "Stop by and see me at the New Amsterdam if you are interested in observing my surgeries. I think we can arrange something."
She wondered if that would be enough to soothe the sting, and if he would be brave enough to take her up on her offer. Many of his colleagues at Bellevue would disapprove.
In the cab, she said, "Really, was that necessary?"
The men looked at her silently.
"All right," Anna said, "maybe it was. But I didn't like it."
"Neither did I, believe it or not," said Oscar.
Anna hummed under her breath. After a moment, she asked,
"Did you get anything useful out of that?"
"A purse," Jack said. "That's something no one mentioned before. We'll go talk to Mrs. Stone. Should we drop you off at home first?" "I think she wants to come along," said Oscar. "Don't you, Anna?"
It was the first time he had called her by her familiar name. It was cheeky, but it was also a compliment.
"You are right. I'd like to see what comes of this purse business. Do I understand correctly that you don't really suspect anyone of taking the money? This is more a way of getting your foot in the door."
Oscar elbowed Jack, who elbowed him back. Jack said,
"You don't have to prove to me that she's got a brain. I knew that the first time I saw her."
Anna leaned back to watch the sky out of the cab's small window. Still full light at 7. She should be tired after such a long day. But there was a humming in her, a sense of the unanticipated. She was in the company of 2 good men who saw things she did not, and valued the things she saw. The Campbell house was on one of the small, crooked lanes that seemed designed to confuse strangers. A few small houses, a couple of ancient cottages that had probably been built when the whole area was pasture or farmland, one newer tenement. Archer Campbell's house was one of the newer houses, but locked up tight. No sign of life, despite Oscar's hammering at doors both front and rear. Anna sat on the edge of the porch while the men consulted. She was a little relieved about this sudden halt to their plans, and wondered at herself that she had been so eager to come along. Now that she was here, even the thought of the man was a challenge to her professional demeanor. The truth was, Campbell wasn't going to be any different today or tomorrow or 10 years down the road than he had been on the stand, full of righteous indignation, convinced that he was the best of husbands and fathers. No doubt he would marry again, and probably soon. Certainly he'd have no trouble finding a wife. There were hundreds of women in the city who would give anything for a home of their own. This modest house would look like paradise to an unmarried daughter in a poor household, as it had once looked to Janine, no doubt. She caught movement from the corner of her eye and saw a woman peeking out from behind the curtains across the way.
"Is Mrs. Stone in the house across the street?"
Jack turned.
"She is."
"I ask because somebody is watching you from the parlor windows."
She got up to follow Jack, with Oscar trailing behind. A shawl would have been a good idea. Her prettiest summer dress was not quite the thing for a call like this one. Maybe she should have gone home after all. With that thought, she realized that she was dreading this conversation. What she remembered of Mrs. Stone on the stand was her willingness to speak her mind and what seemed like real sorrow about Janine Campbell's death. And they had nothing new to offer her, no information that might relieve her mind. Then the door opened to Jack's knock, and a man stood there, rotund, his face as pink as a ham, a great shock of white hair and white eyebrows so long that they fell over his eyes like curtains. He had a sweet but vacant smile, a little confused but welcoming. Veterans of the last war were so common on the city streets that their scars and missing limbs were almost invisible. But this man's injuries could not be overlooked. His left arm had been amputated near the shoulder, and the left side of his head was distorted, with a round indentation over the ear that Anna estimated to be an inch deep at its center.
Mr. Stone?
Oscar's tone was friendly, unremarkable, respectful, perfectly gauged. The smile widened to show shiny pink gums with no teeth at all on the left.
Guten Abend, he said. Ich bin Heinrich Steinmauer. Wer seid ihr?
Then Mrs. Stone was there, her hand on his shoulder to guide him back into the house. She murmured to the old man in German, and he nodded, smiling at her with great affection.
Mrs. Stone, Jack said, we have a few questions regarding Janine Campbell's death. May we impose on you for a short while?
She glanced over her shoulder, unsettled, and then back at them. He's worst in the evenings, she said. My husband, Henry. The evening isn't a good time for him. He was very polite to us, Anna said.
But his mind is wandering. He forgets. He imagines he's back home in Munich where he grew up. We changed our name to Stone years ago, but he forgets even that.
Oscar said, would you like us to come back tomorrow?
Anna was surprised at Oscar's solicitous tone, something she hadn't heard from him before. She said,
no, no, please come in. If we sit quietly with him in the parlor while we talk, he will probably be fine. But he'll speak German to you, please be aware.
Anna might have told her that she spoke German, but she didn't want to draw more attention to herself. Instead, she said, he was wounded in the war.
July of 61 at Bull Run.
My brother died at Bull Run,
Anna heard herself say.
Both Jack and Oscar turned to look at her. Maybe it was the tone of her voice, or the fact that she had yet to tell Jack anything about Paul. In the parlor, Jack lowered his head to speak softly into her ear.
Is this too much, then?
Anna answered Jack by taking a seat on a sofa that creaked with age. The cushions were ancient, but carefully mended at the corners and backed with embroidered antimacassars. While Oscar tried to make himself comfortable with a chair far too small for his bulk, Anna watched Mr. Stone, who sat in a rocker by the window with a small dog in his lap. He was talking to the dog in a way he might have talked to an old friend, or a brother who simply didn't talk very much. She heard him mentioning a carriage going down the street with a single piebald horse, a neighbor who seemed to have forgotten his hat, children chasing fireflies in the new dark. The dog seemed to understand it all, looking obediently where his attention was directed. His tail gave a thump whenever a name was mentioned, as if to comment. Oscar was saying,
now, I believe you said that you left to visit your sister on the day before Mrs. Campbell's death. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. In Albany.
That's a long way to go for a one-day visit. You'd almost have to turn around and come back within a few hours. You were home on Thursday morning.
A little color had begun to creep into her face, but she nodded.
Did you go to the train station with Mrs. Campbell and her sons that Wednesday?
Yes, she said, Her voice was hoarse now, and she cleared her throat. To help with the boys, why do you ask?
Mrs. Stone, Oscar said, where are the boys you helped Mrs. Campbell hide away?
The room was completely silent, but for the ticking of the mantel clock. Anna, as surprised as Mrs. Stone seemed to be, watched the older woman's face flush and then drain of all color. Her fingers were working in her skirts, gathering the fabric and then smoothing it again and again. Jack and Oscar waited patiently, nothing to read from their faces, no judgment or disapproval. Mrs. Stone cleared her throat again.
What do you mean?
I would like to know where the Campbell boys are. Archer, Stephen.
Mr. Stone turned toward them.
Kommen die Buben heute Abend?
There was real excitement and pleasure in his expression.
Kommen die Buben endlich?
Nein, said his wife.
Noch nicht.
Below shaggy eyebrows, the blue eyes lowered in disappointment.
Schade, he said. Montgomery, die Buben kommen immer noch nicht.
My husband loves those boys, Mrs. Stone said a little stiffly. He asks for them every day, many times. I can't explain to him.
What can't you explain? Oscar asked. That they are gone away? That they won't be back? I tell him, but he doesn't believe me.
Because he expects to see them again? Anna suggested. Oscar asked again, quite gently,
Mrs. Stone, what happened to the boys?
She gave him a sharp shake of the head and lowered her chin to her chest. When she looked up again, she said,
Which one? Which one do you want to know about? Let's start with Stephen. Nobody at the inquest asked where the older boys were when the baby was coming into the world. If they had asked me, I would have said. I would have told God and man about those poor boys. Because they were right here with us, with me and Henry. Junior and Gregory were playing with a puzzle in the kitchen, and I was tending to Stephen. He had bloody stripes on his legs and bottom and his back, too. And it wasn't the first time. It wasn't going to be the last, either. Their father used the buckle end of his belt to beat them with. The scars will last those boys a lifetime. And poor Junior.
She sat back, breathless, her mouth pressed hard.
What about Junior? Oscar asked. He didn't beat that boy near as bad as the other two. But he'd say, Junior, which one of your brothers should wear your stripes today? And made him choose. If he hesitated, both boys got the belt. To remind them who was master of the house and that disobedience has consequences. Oh, he loved teaching that lesson. So let me ask you, Detective Sergeant, what would you have done in my place?
She looked at Oscar with something like defiance in her gaze. I can answer that, Anna said. I would have helped Mrs. Campbell get away with her boys, far away where he'd never find her.
Is that what you did?
Yes, Mrs. Stone said, her voice breaking. But it was all for naught now, all for naught. And I promised her I'd get them away safe.
Away to where? Anna asked. From a notebook that sat on the table beside her, Mrs. Stone took a newspaper advertisement. She read it to them in a wavering voice, but Anna had the sense that she could have recited it by heart.
Rhode Island, comfortable cottage for sale, nicely furnished, 8 rooms besides pantry, etc., with chicken house, stable, and small barn, all in good order. 1 acre land, fruit trees, vegetable garden, strawberry bed, pasture.
Good pure water and excellent well. Saconnet Harbor,
$2,000. Inquiries, J. Barnes, Main Street, Little Compton.
There was a long moment's silence while Mrs. Stone tried to gather her composure. She said,
Janine wrote to Mr. Barnes and I mailed the letter.
He wrote back to this address, and after a few letters back and forth, they came to an agreement. She bought the place sight unseen and sent the money express. I said to her, "Janine, you're taking an awful chance." But she was desperate to get the boys away to a safe place. The plan was that we would all live in that house together. She gave her name as Jane Steinmauer, a widow woman coming with the boys and us, her parents-in-law. Henry has never got used to the name Stone anyway, and the boys are young enough to learn to answer to new ones. We'd be like any other family, keeping chickens and a garden. But poor Janine, she never got as far as Rhode Island. She stopped to get her handkerchief from her sleeve and wipe the tears from her cheeks. I went ahead with the boys. Janine came with us to the train station by omnibus, and then I took the boys by cab to the steamer office. The plan was she was supposed to come later in the day. It made me terrible nervous. I was so worried about that cottage. Maybe it would turn out to be a hovel, or maybe it didn't exist at all, but in the end, she was right. It was just the way it's described here. She touched the newspaper cutting. You should have seen the boys. They could hardly have been happier if you set them down in heaven itself. The harbor and the boats and the garden and the house with a nice big kitchen. She pressed her mouth hard, as if she were telling herself to be quiet. She had spoken enough. But the question came out just the same. Can I ask? Did Campbell go to the police saying he'd been robbed? When Oscar said that no complaint had been filed, she nodded. Janine said he wouldn't. That he couldn't tell the police about the money because he didn't come by it honest. Jack said, Mrs. Stone, I'm confused. Campbell told us that he was missing just over $1,200 cash. Where was the money coming from to buy the house? From you?
That almost got him a smile.
All we have is Henry's pension. The bit I make, mending and sewing in this little house I was born in, termites and leaky roof and all.
Do you know how she paid for the Rhode Island house? Oscar asked.
In fits and starts, the story came together. Mrs. Campbell had indeed had something over $1,000 in cash, most of which she had passed to Mrs. Stone when she left with the boys, for the cost of travel and provisions and getting settled in the new house. It was true that was the only cash, but it wasn't the only money.
That's why she stayed behind when I left with the boys, or at least that's what she said. Here it's easier to show you.
Mrs. Stone took up a large sewing basket, set the lid aside, and began to unpack it. There was a tray of threads and a pin cushion, shears, a roll of muslin, patches, a darning egg, knitting needles, a man's shirt neatly folded, a chemise. When it seemed to be empty, she turned it over and thumped the bottom with the heel of one hand. Two solid blows and a false bottom went clattering to the floor, followed by a black pocketbook. With trembling hands, she took out a thick roll of oversized bills. This she handed to Oscar, and he slid a binding string down and off so he could spread the roll flat on his lap.
Bearer bonds, he said, issued by the state of Massachusetts.
The bills were elaborately engraved and printed in three colors. Anna had to look twice before she could convince herself that she was seeing correctly. $500, she said. For each?
46 of them, Mrs. Stone said, of the original 50. That Thursday morning I found her near dead. She gave me the purse with the bonds before the ambulance came. But I'm not keeping it for myself, she added, new color flooding her face. The money is to raise the boys, for food and clothes and school fees and the like, and—
No one suspects you of plotting to steal the bonds, Jack said.
Anna wondered if that was strictly true. She could see the Campbell house through the front windows, still dark.
If Archer Campbell suspected that Mrs. Stone had the bearer bonds, she didn't doubt he was looking for a way to get them back.
Bearer bonds.
Oscar rubbed both hands over his face. Mrs. Stone said,
All I know is Janine said he hadn't come by them honest.
It's not important right now, Jack said. But it's still unclear to me why she didn't just leave with you and the boys that Wednesday morning.
Anna said, She had a doctor's appointment, didn't she?
Mrs. Stone's head dropped.
That was it. I didn't figure it out until later, but she went to that doctor who charged so much to fix things.
She rocked a little in place.
She was so worried about another baby. Sick, really. In her head and heart, both.
She went to that doctor right after she saw me off with the boys. She had a ticket for the noon steamer. That's in the purse still.
But it didn't work out the way she planned.
She told me when I found her Thursday morning, she knew as soon as she left the doctor's office that something was wrong. She was in so much pain and bleeding so bad she couldn't get on a steamer. She could hardly get back here. A fresh welling of tears cascaded down her cheeks.
I get so mad at her when I think about it. What's another baby when there's hands enough to do the work and money to put food on the table?
But she couldn't bear the idea. And so she went and had the operation, and she never lived to see the place she bought, or her boys so happy.
When did you decide to go back to the city to look for her?
Jack asked.
Wednesday evening. She wasn't on the steamer when she was supposed to be, or the one after that. The plan we made was to meet back here if something went wrong, and it did go wrong. If you can imagine it, Janine had to spend another night with that man, knowing she was sick unto death, thinking she'd be dead within a day and what was going to happen to the boys. So I did come back, and thank God. Just before the ambulance came, she gave me the purse with the bearer bonds. She said, Mabel, think how much worse it would be if Archer had realized what I took from him. I wouldn't have anything to give you for the boys. Now you can raise them up, right? And they'll be safe.
Then the doctor came in and examined her in the bedroom. Not 10 minutes later, they put her in the ambulance, and I never saw her again. It's a sin and a shame the way she died. But she went easier, knowing I would go back to the boys. That's all I want, to go back to the boys, me and Henry. But we can't get away. And I don't know how much longer Mrs. Barnes can look after them.
Jack got up and paced the length of the parlor.
You think Campbell suspects?
I know he suspects,
she said almost sharply.
Didn't he say as much right to my face? He said, Mabel Stone, remember one thing. I'll have what's mine. And now he sits there watching us day and night. Like a spider in a web, he watches us. I know he didn't answer when you pounded on the door, but he's there. You can see his cigar. It's like an evil red eye in the dark. I think he's waiting for us both to be out of the house so he can come in and search.
She rocked forward and crossed her arms across her chest, weeping silently but for short indrawn breaths. Anna leaned close and put a hand on the bowed back. The kind of touch that might provide a grieving mother some small comfort. Because Mrs. Stone had lost a daughter in Janine Campbell. They talked for a half hour more, asking questions that Mrs. Stone tried to answer. She didn't know where or how Archer Campbell had gotten some $25,000 in bearer bonds. She didn't know where Janine Campbell had gone for the abortion or who had performed it. All she could say for sure was that she had paid the doctor $300.
She thought it was the only way to get it done quick and safe. And truth be told, I think she got some satisfaction out of the idea that it was Archer's money that paid the doctor.
$300. And for that, he butchered our girl, and now those boys have got nobody. Nobody who knows them and loves them. If we go to them, Campbell will follow. For the bonds, if not the boys.
Jack said, Mrs. Stone, does anybody else know about this? The whole story?
She shook her head. The only person who knows anything at all is a neighbor from down the street. Mrs. Oglethorpe. She stayed with my Henry while I was gone. She thinks I went to my sister, too.
Anna asked, How can you be sure Henry didn't tell Mrs. Oglethorpe anything, given his state of mind?
I can be sure because Mary doesn't speak German, and Henry lost every word he ever knew of English on the battlefield at Bull Run.
Oscar stood up, his expression thoughtful, as he walked toward the window where Mr. Stone sat rocking. He crouched down and smiled at both man and dog, held out a hand to be sniffed, and scratched behind Montgomery's ear.
Henry, he said.
Mr. Stone looked at him expectantly, a smile on his face that could almost be called hopeful.
A fine dog you've got here. His name is bigger than he is, though. Why'd you name him Montgomery?
An uncertain look was all the response he got.
Henry, where are the little boys from across the street?
The smile faded. He turned in his seat to look at his wife, his brows raised.
Schon recht, she said to him. Macht nichts.
To Jack, she said,
The boys and Henry, what's to become of them when you take me away?
Anna had never seen a human being so terribly frightened. Not even the sickest patient with nothing but death to look forward to. Not parents with a desperately ill child. Mabel Stone wasn't frightened for herself, but for the people who depended on her. Anna was about to tell Jack and Oscar that some other solution had to be found when Jack spoke up.
We're not here to arrest you, Jack said. You went with Mrs. Campbell and her sons because you were asked to, and you took the money she gave you to look after the boys. Between us, I think we can find a way to get you and Henry back to those boys. Safely. With the bonds, Oscar added. Campbell will have stolen them somewhere. That's something we'll look into down the road. But you don't have to worry about it. He'll never be punished, but it'll eat him alive. The idea that she got the better of him.
Mrs. Stone looked between them, studying their faces until she seemed satisfied.
You'd think I'd run out of tears?
She folded her damp handkerchief and pressed it to her eyes.
If you mean it, then God bless you.
We mean it, Jack said.
Anna said, Can I ask one more question?
Anything,
Mrs. Stone said. Do you happen to know if Mr. Campbell ever traded at Smithson's, the druggist across from the Jefferson Market? At Mrs. Stone's blank expression, Anna said, Never mind. It was just an idea.
But I do know Smithson's, Mrs. Stone said. It's where my mother traded and where I go. When Janine first moved down here from Maine, I took her there, too, to introduce her. It can't be Mr. Smithson who hurt her. He's as gentle as a lamb and just about as strong. And retired, too, since last year.
I didn't mean to suggest that Mr. Smithson had anything to do with Mrs. Campbell. It's something else that may be related.
Is he in trouble? Nobody is in trouble, Jack said, except the person who operated on Mrs. Campbell. And we don't have any idea yet who that is. But if you think of anything she might have said, no matter how small,
I will come see you. Or write to you if we are already away. When do you think we could leave here? I do need to get back to the boys. And Henry misses them so.
Oscar said.
Could you leave now?
Mrs. Stone's expression stilled. We don't have much luggage, and it's been packed for weeks.
Do you mean it? I do. I can put you two in Montgomery somewhere safe tonight, and tomorrow I'll see to it that you get onto the first steamer headed in the direction of Saconnet Harbor. I'll need a half hour or so sit tight. Jack, you'll want to stay.
Anna could almost hear the silent discussion that went back and forth between them. No doubt Campbell had seen them entering the Stone's house, and by now he would have suspicions. Anna was glad Jack was staying behind. Oscar grinned.
I won't be long, he said. You'll be free of Campbell before you know it.
A few minutes later, when Mrs. Stone had gone to check over their luggage, Anna said, Do I want to know what he's up to? Jack shrugged.
You never know with Oscar. He can be inventive on both sides of the law. But he'll get them to Rhode Island, and Campbell will be none the wiser. You can put money on that much.
We set out to find an answer to one question, and instead we found the answer to a different one altogether. Mrs. Stone came back into the parlor, her agitation and excitement plain to read in the way she sat and then jumped up again. Anna said, Will your husband have trouble adjusting, do you think? You've been in the city for a long time. The older lady sat down again.
He loves those boys so, I don't think he'll care where he is.
She looked at her husband, who had fallen asleep in his rocking chair.
All these years I have missed the Henry I married. But just now it's better this way. He hardly understands what's happening. But you should have seen him as a young man. He had a gift for numbers. He could add and multiply and divide in his head, big numbers, too. And he was so strong. It was a joy just to watch him working.
When he first came from Germany, he came to see my father. He was from Munich, too, to ask about work. He came into the shop, and I was at the counter helping a customer. He smiled at me, and that was that.
As a girl, I hated that we spoke German at home, but Henry made me glad of it, that I could talk to him. I was the one who taught him English, and he made good progress. With other people, it was harder sometimes.
She smiled with such sweetness that she looked much as she must have the day Heinrich Steinmauer came into her father's shop, so many years ago.
Once he wanted to buy a fish for supper.
She stopped.
That's an old story. You won't want to hear it.
Jack said,
I'm always up for a good fish story.
Yes, Anna said. If you don't tell us, I'll be wondering for days. Mrs. Stone started again.
We were at the Fulton Street Market because Henry wanted fish for his supper. There was a big trout he liked the look of, but the fishmonger wanted a dollar for it, and Henry thought it was too much. You see, the fishmonger was rude because of us being German. That used to be even worse than it is these days. So they got to arguing, and they both dug in like bulls. A dollar, says the fishmonger. One American dollar.
Now, back then, when Henry lost his temper, his English got lost, too. So he's yelling in his big, deep voice, That is a shame, a shame. She pushed out her chest and thumped it manfully. And everybody was looking at us and the fishmonger, but Henry was too mad to notice.
He bellows, Behold your fish! I can become a fish myself for 2 bits just around the corner.
Anna laughed. A great bark of laughter that would have embarrassed her in other company. Jack's expression was vaguely confused, a man who dearly wanted in on the joke and would have been glad of the reason to laugh. For some reason Anna couldn't explain, that made her laugh all the harder. That evening, as they got ready for bed, Jack expected Anna would talk finally about her brother. Some small thing that would be a start. The first crack in the dam that held back all the sorrow that ate away at her still, so many years later. It was the last night they would sleep under her aunt's roof. Tomorrow night, they would go to bed in their own place.
He liked the idea of a fresh start, getting the worst and saddest memories out in the light of day. But she went about getting ready for bed, talking about the surgery she would perform in the morning, the hiring of a housekeeper and cook, where she would find the time for Italian lessons, wanting to know if Jack would be in court this week if he was scheduled for night duty. She didn't mention Mrs. Stone or Archer Campbell, and Jack had the idea that she needed to talk to her aunt before they took up the subject. He loved watching her when she didn't realize she was being studied. There was economy in every movement, and she managed still to be graceful in the way she bent from the waist to sweep her long hair to one side, her fingers moving rapidly as she began to plait, working each twist with precision until a long rope fell down her back, and orderly as a rosary but for the stray hair that escaped to curl on her neck, another at her brow. "Jack," he started, coming back to himself with a jerk.
"Sorry," he said. "My mind wandered."
One side of her mouth quirked so that a simple dimple popped to the surface. She knelt on the edge of the bed and bowed down to kiss his cheek, his temple, the corner of his mouth. "Let me guess where it wandered to," she said, and hiccuped with laughter when he grabbed her wrists and flipped her onto her back. "Wait," she said. "Wait. There's something I need to ask." He kissed her soundly until he felt her begin to forget what she had been wanting to say, and then he drew away and settled beside her. She hated to surrender control, or had always hated it. He liked to think that she was coming to see that occasional surrender had its rewards. He watched her make a concerted effort to return her breathing to something more normal.
"Forgot already?"
She elbowed him hard. Then she sat up again, cross-legged, and faced him. "Bambina, she is so bad-tempered at times. Really terrible."
"So I hear."
"From the girls?"
He nodded. "They are very concerned. They like Baldy Ned."
"Oh, no." Anna put a hand over her mouth to smother a laugh.
"It's your fault," Jack said. "Baldy wasn't a good enough name, so you saddled him with another one. The results are already out of your control." "So, I was saying, they're afraid that Bambina scared Baldy Ned away, and they like him."
"He's very personable with the girls."
"He's personable with girls of all ages."
That made her pause. "Bambina never met him before today."
"That doesn't seem to matter. He's got a way of looking at young women that turns their heads. In Bambina's case, that means she's going to go on the attack."
"Something has to be done."
He turned toward her. "You're afraid that if he's around more, she'll do what exactly?"
Anna frowned.
"You don't need to worry about him. He's had a lifetime of standing up to far worse than Bambina."
"That's just it," Anna said. "She's too fragile for the kinds of games he plays."
"Bambina, fragile?"
She shook her head. "Never mind. I see that the male mind is not nimble enough to deal with this situation."
"But yours is."
"Of course." "Wait," she said as he reached for her. "I completely forgot to say that there was a letter from Sophie and Cap yesterday. There were separate letters for everybody, and this one for you and me. I waited to read it with you." She leaned back to take an envelope from her bedside table. "Do you want to hear it?" She was already opening the envelope. "Dear Anna and Jack, we arrived here in reasonable good health and are, I think, settled. Or as settled as we can be. I know Anna will want all the details about the clinic and treatment plan, but for the moment I will just say that I am very satisfied that Dr. Sangarla knows what he's doing and has some promising ideas. The journey was almost more than Cap could bear, and for the first 2 days I feared the trip was a mistake that would make a quick and unhappy end. Then, on the third day, he rallied,
as he has done so often in the past. Now he is distinctly cranky, and what a fine thing it is to have to listen to complaints about the rug on his lap and the sound of cowbells coming from higher pastures in the night. I said I found the cowbells oddly comforting, an alpine counterpoint to the screech of the omnibus he slept through so easily at home. That made him smile. No one here is put off by his mood, and thus he has already given up on it. This morning we sat on a wide balcony overlooking the mountains and valley below, the air cool and refreshing, and the sun mild enough to be pleasant. I was reading aloud from a newspaper when I realized that he had fallen asleep. He looked no older than 17, one arm thrown up over his head and his face turned away from me. For one moment, I thought he had gone, that he had slipped away without a word of farewell, and I sat struck dumb. I remember thinking I shouldn't begrudge him a peaceful end to such a terrible and drawn-out illness, but in my heart I was so angry at him for going without me. Then he stirred, and my heart began to beat again. Now, many hours later, I realize that this trip is as much for me as it is for him. I am learning what it will be like, and when it does happen, I think I will be able to bear it. This letter was meant to offer you the kind of comfort I took from the day's events. I hope I have succeeded. Tomorrow or the next day I will write with more details. In the meantime, ask the girls about their letter. They have a story about a cow in the garden and a very, very ugly dog who sits next to Cap at every opportunity, tail thumping, hopefully, for the tidbits Cap gives him. We are together, and content to make the most of the time left to us in this beautiful place. With great affection and love from both of us, your Sophie and Cap. Postscript. Cap instructs me to say that he wants news of the Campbell situation, gossip from Waverly Place, and a report on how you find marriage. I just want to know that you are happy. Chapter 36. On Friday morning, Jack asked Anna over breakfast if there was a difficult case that was robbing her of sleep. It was true that she was sleeping badly, but she had made every effort to keep her restlessness to herself. "Nothing so worthy," she told him. She thought for a moment and chose her words carefully. "Life is so full. It feels like a waste of time to be sleeping."
"What we need is a rainy Saturday," he said, "with no chance of being called out on an emergency. You might remember then how nice it can be to spend time in bed. I could remind you."
He waggled both brows at her. She made a face at him. "You're not talking about sleeping."
"I am. Maybe not exclusively, but sleeping..."
He stopped and smiled widely.
"In between."
"So then, Detective Sergeant, order up a rainy Saturday, would you?" Mrs. Cabot came to refill their coffee cups, and Anna reminded herself to send Jack's Aunt Philomena a thank you note for finding them the housekeeper. She had sent three. Mrs. Lee had interviewed them one by one and hired Eve Cabot, a Yankee of the first order, born and raised in Maine, an excellent housekeeper and cook. She moved into the bedroom off the kitchen with one suitcase, a pot of violets she put on the windowsill above the kitchen sink, and Skitter, a genial Jack Russell Terrier who hung on every word she said. Anna liked Mrs. Cabot for her dry humor, her refusal to be taken aback by the oddities of the household, and the easy way she was with the girls.
"Anna," Jack said, and inclined his head toward the pocket watch he had put on the table.
She jumped up, kissed Jack's cheek, gathered up her things, and rushed out. But not before Ned came in the kitchen door. He had had his breakfast under Mrs. Lee's watchful eye, and now would allow Mrs. Cabot to feed him, too. It made them happy, and he lived for nothing so much as pleasing the women who fed him.
Anna waved a hand over her head, meant for both hello and goodbye, and studiously ignored the question that followed her out the door. She was almost as far as the Cooper Union when Ned caught up with her, brushing breadcrumbs from his shirt.
"I don't have time to stop," Anna said.
After a full minute of silence, she realized why he was walking along with her and what he was waiting for. "You are a sincere and dedicated teacher," she said to him, "and I pay your fees happily. But sometimes Italian can't be the first thing on my list of priorities." She had stopped in spite of herself and now set off again. He said,
"What's going on with Staten Island?"
That made her pause again, but only momentarily.
"What do you mean? Jack and I got married on Staten Island."
"There's something more," he said. "I heard Margaret talking about it to Mrs. Lee."
Anna had no intention of telling Ned about the Mullen family. They hadn't even decided on how or whether to tell the girls. The inability to come to an agreement was starting to fray the nerves on all sides, but Margaret was having the hardest time. Ned said,
"Does it have something to do with the Russo boys?"
That did bring her up short.
"What exactly did you hear?"
"Not much."
But he looked away.
"I will strangle Margaret," Anna said without heat.
"In the meantime, we need to keep Rosa especially clear of such conversations."
"So it is about her brothers."
Late as she was, Anna stopped to consider this young man who was fast being drawn into both households on Waverly Place simply by making himself indispensable. He spent his afternoons working for the Howells at the Newsboys' lodging, but the rest of the day he was busy making himself welcome among the Savard and Mezzanotte clans. He was a favorite of Margaret, who loved having a young man to mother, of Aunt Quinlan, who liked his banter and quickness of mind, of Mr. Lee, because he was as tireless as a workhorse and would turn his hand to anything, of Mrs. Lee and Mrs. Cabot, who alternately fed and scolded, ordered around, and spoiled him. He was polite but more formal with Chiara and Laura Lee when they were working in the house, probably, Anna thought, because he knew the danger of showing favoritism. Jack had had more than one private conversation with Ned to be sure he understood the boundaries, but Anna hadn't asked for details. Bambina was the only person he hadn't won over. When she and Ned were in the same room, she made a science of expressing her dislike and disapproval in such a way that it was hard to correct or admonish her. Even this didn't seem to worry Ned. Just the opposite. Jack thought Bambina was jealous because the girls were so enamored of him, and Mrs. Lee agreed.
"Things come so easy to him. He only has to snap his fingers and the little girls let everything else drop. We're going to have a talk, Mr. Baldy, Ned, and me."
Everyone was talking to Ned. Anna was as sure as she could be that he would behave himself. Now it seemed like the time had come to take him into closer confidence.
"Can I trust you to do what you can to keep the girls safe and calm?"
He nodded.
"Of course."
"Staten Island does have to do with one of the boys, but it's a very delicate situation. Telling Rosa at this point would make things much more difficult. But we do need a plan. We can talk about that tonight once the girls are asleep. I'm trusting you to keep an eye on things until then."
He gave a sharp bow from the shoulders as neatly as a soldier.
"I've got to get back. Bambina is coming over to hang some curtains, and you know how she looks forward to insulting me."
Anna watched him run off, switched her Gladstone bag to her other hand, and picked up her pace. Elise generally saw little of Anna during the workday, and when they did cross paths, she made herself small. She had begun to make some friends among the nurses and medical students. She didn't want to draw attention to the fact that Dr. Savard, who frightened almost everyone, had taken Elise under her wing. They were likely to accuse her of getting special treatment, which was, in fact, the case. But there was another truth, one she reinforced with all her energy and concentration every day. She didn't take advantage. She worked very hard, asked no favors, and offered her help wherever she could, both at the hospital and on Waverly Place. And still today, just as she was finishing her shift, Anna sent for her. Elise found her with her advanced medical students, all of them getting ready to leave the building.
"I thought you might want to come with us," Anna said, "to see a thyroidectomy. It's a very challenging operation. I myself have never done one. Not yet."
10 minutes earlier, Elise had been looking forward to the garden and putting her feet up for the 20 minutes she allotted herself. Now she felt as though she could sprout wings and fly. They set off for New York Hospital on foot, matching Anna's quick pace. Elise was curious about the surgery, but she kept her silence and listened to the snatches of conversations that came to her about exams, a visit home, a lost notebook, a recent case they had been called on to write up as an assignment, and how strictly Dr. Savard marked their efforts. She wondered if these young women talked about Anna when she was out of earshot, and decided that they almost certainly did, about her classes and expectations, but also about a recent marriage. One of the nurses had approached her and asked straight out, was it true Dr. Savard had married an Italian? Because she couldn't indulge in irritation, Elise feigned confusion. Better to be thought a little dim than to gossip about the person who had made this new life possible. Even when the subject wasn't forbidden, Elise often found herself at a loss, listening to the young women talk among themselves. They were hardworking, ambitious, and serious about their studies. They had made choices knowing full well that the goals they set for themselves would likely cut them off from the things most young women hoped for. Some of them would marry, according to Anna, but most would not. And still, they admired men and thought of them as potential mates, or at least bed partners. Chiara had been the one to point out to Elise that men watched her.
"Watch me? Why? Why not? You're pretty."
"I'm odd-looking," she ruffled her short hair.
"You're pretty in an uncommon way, and you move like a ballerina."
Upon close questioning, it turned out that Chiara had never seen a ballerina except on a poster, but she stuck stubbornly to her assessment.
"I am a dumpling in the making," Chiara insisted. "It's the family curse. At 50, I'll blow up."
She puffed out her cheeks to demonstrate. "But you've got long legs and a long neck and skin like silk. Men watch you because you're nice to look at." The whole subject made her uncomfortable. But Chiara had started something that Rosa picked up on. When they were out in public together, they kept a constant vigil and pointed out every admirer, some of which Elise truly believed they manufactured solely to fluster her. On the omnibus, a fair-haired man with a stack of books on his lap. A clerk at the notions counter at Denning's Dry Goods, with ears that stuck out from his head. The grooms standing beside Stewart's stables, cheeky monkeys every one. They swore that there were 3 different young men living in the Jansen apartments just across the way who had gotten into the sudden habit of walking past the house at least twice a day, morning and evening. Chiara made up names for each of them, and jobs, too. Alto was the tallest one and an assistant manager at a bank. Bruno had a big dark brown beard and taught at the Academy of Music, and Bello, with a face like an angel, was a passenger agent on the White Star line, and all of them lived for a glimpse of Elise.
"If you're right about this," she wanted to know, "why haven't any of them said a word to me?" "Because you are pretty but distant. What's the word?"
"Uninterested."
"That's not it. Distante. Aloof."
Elise wondered if it was true.
Did strangers see her as arrogant? Conceited?
These were serious character flaws that were dealt with summarily in the convent. Had she learned them in the few weeks since she left? This line of thought stayed with her until they reached the hospital, where they filed through the doors like so many schoolgirls. The smell of carbolic and lye soap stripped away all the trappings, and just that easily, they were physicians in training. Sober, observant, somber. It was a relief to be back in a familiar environment, where there were things to occupy her beyond the mysteries of men. There was, in fact, a delicate, dangerous procedure that involved wielding a scalpel to remove the thyroid, cocooned in veins, embedded in the platysma, sternothyroid, and thyroid muscles at the base of the throat, without damaging carotid arteries, leaving the trachea and the larynx intact. She wondered if they might get a piece of the tissue to study under a microscope. Anna sent her students back to the New Amsterdam and went in search of an orthopedic surgeon she knew, hoping he'd have a minute to discuss a case. His office door stood open, and the office was empty. But she could hear a conversation going on farther down the hall, and so she went to investigate. Dr. Mayfair stood with two colleagues in a triangle, their heads bent together. She began to back away, but David Mayfair looked up and caught sight of her.
Dr. Savard, he gestured for her to come closer. Let me introduce you.
There were reasons for her to be on her way, but it was a rare opportunity to meet with male colleagues who saw her not as an upstart or a threat, but as an equal. It made her nervous, she could admit that, because she so much wanted to be accepted. Striking the right tone was far more tiring than surgery, this kind of interaction.
We were just talking about one of Dr. Harrison's cases, Dr. Mayfair said. A young mother, and a terrible loss. You do more gynecological surgery than anyone here. Maybe you could make more sense of it.
All thoughts of the cuneiform osteotomy she had wanted to discuss disappeared. She cleared her throat.
What kind of case?
Emil Harrison was a slight man of average height with a luxurious head of hair and the habit of picking at his beard. Anna couldn't ever recall hearing his name before, but there were so many physicians in the city, that was nothing unusual. He seemed to be hesitant, and Anna was ready to excuse herself when Albert Vesnevsky spoke up.
I'd like to hear her opinion.
Fine, let's go have a look.
Harrison didn't sound as though he relished the idea. David Mayfair said,
It's too bad your students have gone already, Dr. Savard. This would have been an excellent experience.
The phrase that kept coming back to Anna later was excellent experience. David Mayfair wasn't purposefully trivializing what had happened to the dead woman, and in fact, he was more respectful than most. But it was an irritation and one she could do nothing about, especially when he had gone out of his way to include her. Young women studying medicine would have to learn this lesson as well. On the way to the morgue, Emil Harrison gave her his patient's history. He had been treating Irina Dmitrievna Svetlova for 5 years and knew her quite well. Age 28, born in St. Petersburg, the wife of a professor of Russian language and literature at Columbia College. Two sons, both born in New York, and delivered by a German midwife without incident. The boys were thriving, and neither had there been anything wrong with Irina Svetlova, except the fact that she was pregnant and did not want to be. Dr. Harrison didn't perform abortions, and did not refer her to any other doctor who might have done the procedure for obvious reasons. But on Thursday morning he had been called to their home.
The note said only that she was unwell, Harrison went on.
The Svetlovas lived in an elegant French flat on Fifth Avenue, where he found her in danger of her life.
My first inclination was to attend her there so that she could die at home with her family nearby. But her husband insisted on a laparotomy.
Something in the back of Anna's mind suddenly became clear. They only knew about the deaths that came to the attention of the authorities. There could be many more. Women who had gone home to die and been tended to by their own people. That idea so distracted her that she found it hard to shift her attention when they reached the morgue. Anna steeled herself, but it was no good. No human being could look upon such devastation and remain unmoved. The post-mortem would reduce what had happened to this woman to cold observations. Tears and puncture wounds to the cervix, uterus, omentum, large intestine, and the body's frantic response to the invasion of bacteria, infection, exudate, and pus. What had been a well-formed, healthy human body laid waste.
"Have you ever seen such an extreme example of malpractice?"
Mayfair asked her. "I'm sorry to say, I have," Anna answered. "Almost exactly like this. Do you know who did the procedure?"
"No," said Harrison. "By the time I saw her, she was convulsing from the fever. She never regained consciousness."
"The husband?"
"He's in shock."
"I'd like to talk to him, if I may." Anna found Professor Svetlov sitting in the main lobby, his hat clamped between his hands, his head lowered. At the sound of her voice, a tremor ran through him. "Professor Svetlov," Anna repeated. "May I speak with you? I'm Dr. Anna Savard." Anna dealt with grieving husbands and fathers, brothers and sons, every day. She strove for calm compassion without emotional attachment. But it was a battle that would never be completely won. When she had introduced herself again and expressed her condolences, she forced herself to look him directly in the eye and ask her question. "Professor, do you have any idea who she went to for this procedure?" He shook his head, a single sharp jerk. "Any information would be useful for the detectives. You don't know what part of the city she went to, how much money she paid, how she heard about his services." His voice came raw and rough.
"I don't know any of that. She went out in the morning. She came back early afternoon and went straight to bed. She wouldn't open the door to anybody. This morning, when I finally got in to see her."
He pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes and shook his head.
"Please, leave me in peace."
Jack was working the night shift, but there was no end of things to keep Anna busy. She could spend the evening reading journals or marking papers, and she owed Sophie a long letter. She could go visit with Aunt Quinlan and Margaret, or spend some time with the little girls. What she couldn't do was talk to anyone about Irina Svetlova. Talking to the woman's husband, trying to talk to him, had been a mistake, and she hadn't even asked the most important question. It seemed unlikely that a wealthy Russian woman would ever have had occasion to frequent Smithson's, located as it was in the shadows beneath the elevated train, but she would leave that determination to the honorable detective sergeants. They never presumed to perform surgery, and from now on she would leave the police work to them, unless, of course, they specifically asked her for help. With that self-admonishment clear in mind, she finished changing into casual clothes and went downstairs to find mail on the hall table. A letter from her cousin Blue, Aunt Quinlan's oldest daughter who still lived in Paradise at Uphill House, where Anna had been born. Another from one of the Savard cousins in New Orleans. Sales offers from medical supply companies and publishers, a newsletter from the Women's Medical Society, and one rough envelope with handwriting that was unfamiliar, rather old-fashioned and stiff. For a moment, she contemplated not opening it at all. If it was another of Comstock's traps, it would ruin the rest of her evening.
but she took it to a window to study it more closely and was able to make out the postmark. Just barely. Mailed 2 days before,